Good evening and welcome to the April 16th, 2018 meeting of the Astoria City Council. Glad to see you all here. Roll call, Chief Spalding.
Councilor Nemiro.
Here.
Councilor Rouse.
Here.
Councilor Rice.
Here.
Councilor Jones.
Here.
Here. Thank you. First, we have a presentation from the Chamber of Commerce, and we have the outgoing director and the incoming director. So, Skip, are you starting? Or okay, Skip Hockey.
Yes, Madam Mayor. Skip Hockey, 92732 Deer Valley Road, Astoria. I have, before I begin, I have two pieces of very good news. One, 2 weeks from now, I'm retired. And the next piece of good news is that David Reed is taking my spot. And he's going to do a terrific job. It's been a great run for me for 13 years. And I'm going to miss it tremendously. But I'm going to enjoy the next step, too. But my duty tonight is to give you a report on the second or the first and second quarter of fiscal year. And I gave you documents, three documents, the media coverage from July 2017 through December 2017, first and second quarter fiscal year transit room tax collection, and the 6 month financials ending 12/31. And I'd like to go over those and just cut some high points of the reports. And if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me. But let's start with the media coverage. Remember, while it's a pretty good package, it's only 6 months. So we get a lot of coverage. And the money you spend for marketing, $180,750 is money I think well worth spent. We get a tremendous amount of free advertising and free publicity and public relations. We utilize Maxwell PR in Portland and Robeson Communication. And just to give you an indication of how we spend that money, Maxwell gets $95,000 a year. Robeson gets $75,000. We did brand refreshment this year, and it's in progress right now, just to bring us up to date and refresh everything we've got, we're putting out there. North Coast Marketing may be new to some of you. We started it several years ago, and we put in $25,000. Also, Seaside participates, Cannon Beach participates, Warrenton participates, everybody participates, and we pool that and we advertise and market the North Coast using the scenario that if somebody comes to Seaside to spend 2-3 days or a long weekend, they're going to be in Astoria too. And likewise, if they come to Astoria, they're going to go to Seaside. And so it's proved to be very successful from all standpoints that we're hearing about anyway. And everybody is participating. Meeting planners at $7,000 is a committee within LCTC, and their job is to help plan. When we get a call from somebody saying we've got 35 people, we'd like to bring them to the coast for a meeting, then it's meeting planners' job to see what they can do to assist them. And if there's a decision they're made on where they're going, to try to guide them this way. And it's working. And then website and photo software, we put $12,500 into that. We just have to keep that up every single year. So that's basically in round figures where the money goes, the high points of the spending of Lower Columbia Tourism Committee. The next item you got was the financials. If you look at that, you'll see the largest part of the expenditure is the Chamber and Visitor Services. We have a revenue budget of $917,000. Of that, $164,000 comes from the city of Astoria and the city of Warrenton, with Astoria paying 125 and about 40 coming from Warrenton. And so that leaves $750,000 that comes from the chamber itself. And we get this from chamber activities, membership dues, and our very successful events that we put on, with one coming up in the next couple of weeks, the Crab, Wine, and Seafood Festival. My guess is we probably bring in more resources off our events than any other chamber in the state. We're very, very fortunate. But then again, we've been at it a long time with both the Crab Seafood Festival and the Great Columbia Crossing being 35 years old. And we keep adding new, smaller events. So we're very, very fortunate. And we have a very special town when we come to events. In 2 weeks at the Crab Festival, we need a grand total of 269 volunteers just to put it on. And we are, what, David, at 75% right now?
100%, yes.
And we're ahead of last year. So we'll meet that total, and I don't know what we'd do. This whole area is a very volunteering town, and we're very, very fortunate for that. Oftentimes, when we present the financials and the budget, and we go before the budget committee, they have asked us to separate what money goes to visitor services, which you folks fund, and what monies go to the chamber. Now, maybe David will be smarter than I am to figure out how to do that. I simply cannot. In my opinion, it cannot be done. It can't be separated. And the reason being, we have four full-time employees and two half-time employees. And no matter what their job responsibilities, like Regina is in charge of marketing, and Kelsey is in charge of events, and Mark Quilla is in charge of membership, it doesn't make any difference what their responsibility is. Their number one priority is giving service to our visitors. If they walk into the lobby, their job is to take care of people. If they're walking across the parking lot and somebody's coming the other way, it's their job to greet that visitor. And so every single person in the whole organization is part of visitor services. So I don't know how we can split it up and even it up to make everybody happy. In my mind, we just can't do it, because everybody does. I'm on the phone a lot. I greet customers when the lobby is full. David will be doing exactly the same thing. And we only have one full-time employee in visitor services. But you can't run a visitor service with one full-time employee. I think the visitor services aspect of the contract we have with the city of Astoria gets supplemented by the Chamber of Commerce. And that's fine, because the only way you can separate is if you take the visitor services away from our building and put it in a separate location. And to be honest, I don't think you can do that for $125,000 a year. And so we're very pleased with it. We like visitor services with us. We enjoy it. It's the best part of the job is meeting and greeting the new people coming in from all over the world. But that's part of our job. But I hope you can understand why I think it's difficult to separate them entirely. So we just kind of have to put them all together. The next item I'd like to speak to, and you'll see it with a pink tab there, is room tax dollars. This is pretty exciting for me and for our operation. Remember what we're being paid to do. We're being paid to bring visitors to this area to spend dollars, and we're paid to do it in the off season. We don't need a lot of help bringing people here in the summertime. And we do remember the fact that we don't spend a single penny except in off season times. Okay? So keeping that in mind, if you look at current year first quarter, $775,000, let's call it $776,000 first quarter in room tax dollars. Uh-oh, this will make some people happy that don't want a lot of tourists here. We're actually down this year from last year. Last year we had almost 800,000. So we're down in that peak season. But when you go to off-season, October, November, December, $518,805 this year, $431,660 last year. So a nice increase. Now I'd like to take it one step further. I want to look back 5 years because you need to see that we're doing our job bringing people in here in the off season. 5 years ago, we had $172,000 in room tax dollars in that quarter, in the off season, the October, November, December. This year, $518,000. 200% increase in 5 years. We're bringing them in at the right time. We're filling the rooms, and we're bringing people into our restaurants and into our shops. And that's what you pay us to do. And I think with the aid you folks give us, I think we're doing it. I think we're proving it. And I don't think you'd find another organization in the state that can give you the same figures in the off season. So I'm very, very proud of that. So we had in 5 year period, we had a 63% increase in the summertime business and a 200% increase in the off season business. I just received a report today, you folks may not have it yet, Susan does, I'm sure, and this doesn't have to do with the first two quarters, but we also had an increase in the third quarter and up about $68,000 over last year. And that's good news. If in the fourth quarter, if we do only what we did last year, we will break $2 million in room tax dollars this fiscal year. And that's a new record, I believe, right, Susan? I guess it would be. I haven't seen it before anyway. I mean, we've come a long ways, a long way. And so I think we definitely are going in the right direction and filling up the rooms. And we're hearing good reports from the lodgings. Another thing I have to bring you up to date on, your chamber just went into debt. We just borrowed $60,000, not city money. We borrowed it from a local bank and for the second phase of our remodel project. And you are all invited to come see it. I think you'll be impressed. This project is for the visitors only. Our offices didn't get improved. We didn't get new carpeting. David wanted a hot tub. He didn't get it. But it's only in the lobby, and we took out a small storeroom and totally revamped it for brochure display. And we received a $13,000 grant from Clatsop County about a year ago from their room tax dollars in the county. We used that to purchase the brand new state-of-the-art brochure racks. They're just beautiful. They have storage behind them, so you got your Astoria Visitor Guide, and when you run out, all you have to do is open the door and it's stacked right there. You got to come in and see them. New carpeting, brand new restrooms, revamped everything. They're now up to the latest code and new lighting, and it turned out very nice, very nice. That's the second phase. Third phase, I don't care about. I won't be there anyway. And David's office is plenty good, I think. So, that'll be up to the next group of people. But you have to come in and see it. It's really turned out nice. And since this is my last opportunity to speak to you folks, and I know I've said this before, but you really have to understand it. We have a very, very unique relationship between the Chamber and the Visitor Center and the Marketing Group and the City of Astoria and the City of Warrenton. I talk to a lot of my peers throughout the state, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen elsewhere. They're at odds with their city manager. They're at odds with their city councilors. They're always complaining they don't get what they want, and they don't get support. And we have been extremely fortunate, and I am very, very proud of what together we have accomplished. It's huge. It's huge. And I know that under David and the superior staff that we have at the Chamber, that success rate will continue. And I don't know if David has anything to add at this point, but if you guys have any questions, we're happy to answer them. That is probably the shortest report I've ever had, and that's okay. So, David, do you have anything to add?
I do not, unless you have questions for me.
Pardon?
I do not, unless the council has
questions. Okay, any questions from any of the councilors?
I have just one question, and thanks very much, Skip, for all your work, all the time you've been with the Chamber, and the excellent report tonight. So just based on the numbers or the preliminary indications you gave, even though I know there's not a figure on the paper for the first quarter of the calendar year, regarding the increase to the lodging tax, which council voted last year to implement as of January 1 of this year, I'm wondering what, if any, impact are you seeing from that lodging tax change?
I don't hear all that well. What was that?
I was asking about any impact of the lodging tax increase, which we voted on last year.
We all start to shake whenever we hear increase. But, and I hope there's no lodging members here, but I don't think it makes any difference at all. We're not the highest in the state, that's for sure. There are places a lot higher than we are, and they get people to come to their town too. I think people are used to the idea that you're going to have taxes to pay, and they're going to increase the tax. And so we all worry about it, but I think the records show it hasn't stopped anywhere, and that's a good thing. So,
yeah. Thank you very much.
They'll keep coming.
Thank you.
Nothing.
Well, Skip, thank you very much for your years of service. You've really done a fantastic job, and we wish you a very happy retirement.
It has been my pleasure. I tell everybody, I've lived in this town all my life. I was in the grocery business for 40 years, and this has been the best job I've ever had. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, before we have reports of counselors, I see some students sitting there in the back, and I wonder if you would stand up and introduce yourselves. Tell us where you're from.
My name is Vanessa Edmund, and I'm from Napa High School.
I'm Alyssa White, I'm also from Napa High School.
My name is Sophia Hansen, I'm also from Napa High School.
Okay, is this part of a class assignment?
Yeah, we're supposed to attend three city-type meetings. And so we chose this one, and we're also going to attend a school board meeting and another type of meeting.
Well, how fun for you. Okay, well, welcome. We're glad to have you here tonight.
Madam Mayor, may I make one more comment?
Sure.
I had it written down and I forgot. You guys can be very proud of your city manager. And I am too. He is an advisory member on my board of directors, and he's the only city manager in my history that very seldom misses one of my meetings. So he's there all the time. He's your own personal watchdog at our at our chamber meetings, and he does participates well. So I really appreciate the support that Brett has given the chamber.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next item is reports of counselors. You didn't have anything to add, David. Is that right? Okay. Reports of counselors. Counselor Nimlowell.
Nothing to report tonight, Mayor. I'm going to miss you, Skip, and I think you've done a great job. Congratulations on such a successful career.
Counselor Brownson.
I just wanted to mention last council meeting, I mentioned that I'm on a couple of League of Oregon City committees, and I was at one today in Salem, taxation and finance, and we reviewed state and shared revenue, and it's sort of interesting, again, to go down the list and what revenue trickles our way from the state and looking at ways to improve that or clarify it. And a great example that came up was 9/11 funding. So, you know, there's 75 cents per phone is taxed and goes to 9/11 funding. And one of the things that was really interesting is that despite the proliferation of cell phones, so a lot more phones out there than there used to be, revenues are still kind of flat. And they're sort of wondering why that hasn't increased with all the phones. And I mentioned that cable companies aren't collecting on their phones probably on this either. So just places to look at. And the other thing was that the funding that revenues that are collected for 9/11 do fully fund state costs, but they only fund 25% of local costs. That means that we have to, the rest of us, the locals, have to pay for the rest of 9/11 services. And so we're looking for trying to resolve some of these inequities. And I think that's a great example of what we're trying to do there. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Price.
Yes, Skip, congratulations on a great career. Always the biggest cheerleader for Astoria. You'll be missed. I just had the great pleasure of delivering to Angela Cosby a check made out to the city of Astoria from the Samuel Johnson Foundation of $5,000. You'll remember that a few months ago a truck landed on the east side of the Doughboy and exploded some lampposts and other things, and the city had a grant from another organization, perhaps from the state, I'm not sure, to do a partial renovation. This $5,000 donation allows for a more comprehensive renovation of the Doughboy. It's really great to have it, and she donated it both because military is very important to her. Her parents were both in the military, but also because of a great report with a budget, et cetera, that Angela and the Parks team put together for the renovation. So congratulations.
Evening, Mayor.
Councilor Jones.
Happy retirement, Skip. Welcome aboard, Dave. That is all.
Okay, well, there are quite a few congratulations I want to mention tonight. We have two police officers who just graduated last Friday from the DPSST. What does that stand for?
That's the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. That's the State Police Academy and Fire Academy.
Okay. Andrew Murray and Levi Winfrey. So we're delighted that they have done that, and they will begin a 3 to 4 month field training program, and then they'll be out in the field as regular officers. So we're delighted with that. I also wanted to mention John Gutenberger. You probably saw in the paper that he will receive an Oregon Heritage Excellence Award for his consultation, his work with nonprofits, and his part in creating the historic preservation and restoration program at Clatsop Community College. What an asset to our city. John's just kind of a city treasure. And then the last congrats is to Jim Hatcher, who is our new public works superintendent. And that person is down at the shops, what are referred to as the shops across from the fire and police department. And he takes over from Ken Nelson. So we're glad to welcome him aboard as well. I was able to take a tour of the USS Portland. Some of you probably saw that ginormous, gigantic, gargantuan ship that was down at the port. And so we took a tour and were given a photo of the ship and also the symbol from the ship. We were out on the flight deck. Which end was that? Okay, stern. Okay, thank you. We were on the stern. And the wind was blowing about 50 miles an hour, and the rain was coming horizontally. And I thought we were all going to blow right off that ship. But it was amazing. We got to see the Osprey. Some of you may know a whole lot more about the Osprey than I do, and also know which end of the ship you go on. But at any rate, it was a really neat experience. Also got a cap from the USS Portland. But that was wonderful. Then that night, there was a dinner for the whole crew from the ship, and so it was 300 plus people at the Elks, and Karen Martins did her usual wonderful job of feeding all those folks, and so that was that celebration. And then Brett and I presented to an Encore class. Encore, for those of you who don't know, is for 55 plus age, that is. Folks up at the college, and it was the U.S. Constitution class, and so we talked about our respective roles as city manager and mayor. So that was fun. And then I'm surprised you didn't mention this too, Cindy, but we did go to the gutter party presentation, and that was really wonderful. It's probably one of the most humiliating things I have ever done, though, because I was lost in the first place. I didn't know where they were because I got there at 12 o'clock where they were going to put the plaque in, and nobody was there, and the rain was pouring down, and the wind was blowing. And so I went back home and got a call from Brett, and he said, oh, we moved into the Holiday Inn Express. So back down I went. And I was dressed in my rain suit. You know, I thought it was going to be outside, and so I had my rain jacket, my rain pants, my rain boots, classy looking. And I walk in, and there were all these women dressed in beautiful saris and men in suits with beautiful turbans, and here I am. I felt like the gardener. And of course, Willis Van Dusen says, oh, here's our mayor. Come on up and say a few words. And I just wanted to hide in the corner. Anyway, it's a great plaque. Go down and see it. It's by the Shively Fountain down there. The AAUW Candidates Forum, I read a statement from Suzanne Bonamici. What happened that night was rather interesting, too. This has been a funny week. I was introduced as the ex-mayor, and I wasn't sure whether there had been a coup the night before that I didn't know about or what. But anyway, I'm here. So... are there any changes to the agenda?
There are no changes to the agenda.
Okay. Then the consent calendar is considered routine and is just passed with one motion unless someone has asked for an item to be removed. Any requests from the public?
No public request.
How about from the council? Okay, could we have a motion?
I move we approve the consent calendar.
Second.
Okay, Chief Ames.
Councilor Price.
Aye.
Councilor Mendel.
Aye. Councilor Jones.
Aye.
Councilor Brown.
Aye.
Admiral, I mean, Mayor.
Okay, regular agenda items. The first one is the authorization to award the contract for the Spur One combo harvest.
A commercial thinning and variable retention project is proposed on about 50 acres of the Bear Creek watershed property for this summer. And the Bear Creek watershed is where Astoria's drinking water comes from. And we own property up in that area east of Astoria. A description of this variable retention and thinning is included in the council memo, but we do have our city forester, Ben Hayes, here tonight, who is present to be able to answer any questions the council may have. But at your March 5th meeting, the council authorized staff to solicit bids for a for the tree thinning and retention project up in the watershed. And on March 26th, the city received one responsive bid from Hampton Tree Farm, as noted in your memo. I would note that the harvest is estimated to result in gross revenue of $259,400.86. And again, these funds, after any required expenses are made, would be deposited into the capital improvement fund for the city. Tonight, it's recommended that council award the Spur One combo harvest to Hampton Tree Farms. And again, Ben Hayes, our city forester, is in the back of the room and can answer any questions that council may have.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, the mayor and I received an email asking if this harvest could not be delayed until after the hatchlings are gone from the trees. And I assured the writer that this was a summer harvest, but I couldn't assure her about the hatchlings. So can you tell us about the birds and the trees?
Yeah, so there are two pieces there. One is we do operate in a very restricted operating season compared to most operators. So most operators operate year-round, and there are places in the watershed that you physically could do that, but we've decided to restrict to the summer months, primarily for water quality issues. But also in terms of wildlife, that is after the primary breeding season. To follow up on that, we did pull up Audubon's best management practices for nesting birds, and they list two breeding seasons, and our typical operating window is after those two breeding seasons. In addition, we contacted the Oregon Department of Forestry, and we do this every year as part of every timber sale. And the closest threatened and endangered bird species are 2 to 4 miles away for known habitat that does not include known populations.
Wonderful. So when will this harvest take place?
Their operating window begins in June, but typically they operate in late July to August. So for the driest part of the year.
Very comprehensive answer. Thank you.
Yeah. I wondered, how many acres in our Bear Creek watershed altogether?
Yeah, there's just over 3,700 acres in that property.
Any other questions? Okay. Could we have a motion then?
I move that we award the Ridgeline Combo Harvest to Hampton Tree Farms, LLC.
And Councilor, there was a typographical error, in that, so it should be the Spur One Combo Harvest rather than Ridgeline, as was noted in the memo.
I move that we award the Spur
One.
Say it again.
Spur One Combo.
Combo to Hampton Tree Farms.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Next item is the waterfront bridge replacement project.
And this is a subject which has come back to the city council a number of times over the past few years, but this deals with where the city's numbered streets between 6th and 11th meet the Columbia River. There's a short bridge which connects solid ground to overwater pier structures that extend into the Columbia. And in September of 2014, the city entered into an IGA, intergovernmental agreement, with ODOT to begin the project, and that was the design phase of rebuilding these 6 bridge structures. So we've gone through the design process, and tonight we're going to have our project engineer, Cindy Moore, give an update on that. But tonight's action deals with a local agency agreement for the construction phase of the waterfront bridges replacement project. The total estimated project cost for the construction phase is $9,508,000, which includes construction by a low bid contractor who is yet to be determined. ODOT will secure the contractor, the low bid contractor, for this project once we're moving forward. The city's portion of this project is 10.27%, or $976,471.60. That will be the total amount, with the remaining to be paid for by ODOT. You may recall that we have secured a loan through the Infrastructure Finance Authority for preliminary construction funds to be able to start this project, and we will have essentially a refinance, a new loan, which will come once the project is complete. So Cindy's going to be giving an update on the project tonight, but ultimately we're asking council to approve the local agency agreement with ODOT for the waterfront bridges replacement project. Cindy?
Cindy Moore, Assistant City Engineer. Just a real brief update on the project. I have a couple of images to show you that you've seen before. This one here shows the project location, and the numbers indicate which bridges are being constructed first in the first in-water work period, and then which ones in the second. So the first in-water work period are the odd-numbered streets, and specifically starting with 11th Street. And then in the second in-water work period, which is between November and February, we'll be doing the even-numbered streets. So I just want to remind you, I know we've talked about that a number of different times, but that is our strategy. And as far as the status, I'm showing this image just to remind you also what they're going to look like as we get into construction. So we're at a critical point in this extremely complex project, a very exciting yet stressful point in this. Some important tasks have been completed, including the marine mammal permit. I don't know if you remember early on in this project, that was when we were concerned that might affect the schedule. We have that one. We have all our private property easements and deeds that you've been involved with. The final plans and specs have been completed by our consultant, OBEC. And this agreement with ODOT is really a pretty big hurdle that we're excited to have accomplished, the one that's before you tonight. The last remaining item is our SHPO permit, which, and if you remember, SHPO is our State Historic Preservation Office. This one has come a little bit at a surprise that it's lingering here at the end. It's critical that we get this permit in the next, 3 weeks, to keep this project on schedule for construction to begin this fall. So our team, including ODOT, the consultants, and even Federal Highway Administration has gotten involved because this is a federally funded project and their money is at stake. So we're all working very hard to get that completed. When we get that permit, it gets incorporated into the Army Corps joint permit. So there's some time involved getting that included into their permit and issued for the project. This project is being bid under ODOT's authority. So we support that effort, but we don't have as much control as we do with our own projects when we bid our own projects. So we're at the mercy of what their requirements are and what they will allow to be bid with if something was coming in a week or two. So we're tracking this very closely, and everyone is poised for success, but it is a critical time. And I expect probably the second meeting in May, we'll be able to give you an update on where we're at with that critical item. Does anybody have any questions?
Well, I just, thank you so much for your work on this complicated project. And there's so many staff members here who have had a role in it, the city manager and public works director and finance director, our city attorney, and I'm sorry if I'm forgetting anybody. But, you know, thank you very much for trying to keep the project on track, and fingers crossed that SHPO cooperates in our timeline. I'm curious, you know, as we embark on the last leg of the Riverfront Vision Plan implementation, you know, knowing what you know about waterfront bridges, is there anything you think the city maybe should consider in future planning in terms of waterfront development? Anything to keep in mind with these bridges? You know, whether or not it should be the city responsibility, a private developer? I just, you know, that question mark is kind of coming up because it seems like it's very complicated and costly to the city to update these bridges.
Oh, absolutely. So some of that's out of my purview, and I could give you my opinion, but that gets more into the planning realm. As far as the bridges are concerned, we are building them to a 75-year design life. So that's a conservative number. These would likely, barring any extreme event, be there for 100 years easily. A lot of the considerations that you guys have been involved in and we've gotten input on is keeping things simple, keeping designs simple, not getting too extravagant. So any improvements, I suppose, you know, with private development that might be connecting to the bridges, that would be the theme that we would support moving forward. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it's probably something we're just going to kind of have to keep in mind, yeah, you know, for when we go through the implementation process in the urban core portion of the Riverfront Vision Plan. Thank you.
Right. And Councilor Immelwell, just to maybe add on a little bit, you know, what we're going to be rebuilding here is all the areas that are under the City of Astoria's jurisdiction. And so there will be areas north of these bridges that will continue to be privately owned and maintained. And the vision plan anticipates that if there were any improvements out there, that while there could be privately owned and maintained structures in the rights of way, they would need to be public, be able to provide that access. So, you know, what at least, you know, that would be anticipated is that for any city improvements that would come on in the future in the right of ways, we would probably have very little that we would take on as any maintenance requirements, but there would be requirements to provide that access, that open flow for the public to be able to get out and around those buildings, but on private property with easements.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, to follow up on that just a little bit, so what about structurally between the bridges? What's the condition? Are there issues that we have in that particular area that we are going to have to address? And this kind of follows up with what you were saying, because that's, if there is development, it's going to extend out from the Riverwalk, right? And so that Riverwalk structurally, is that all, are we anticipating problems, costs, and maintenance that are large other than...
So let's start off saying that, you know, as a part of this project, there will be portions of the, we differentiate street ends from trestles. That's how, in the lingo internally, we differentiate the differences between the two. And a street end is in the public right-of-way, and it's something that provides legal access to waterfront properties. The trestles are between the street ends. We know that as a part of this project, there's that interface where the trestles connect to the street ends. And we are going to have to do some work to rebuild those or make the connections, which are not funded by the grant. That's part of our loan that we're taking out, that's going to include some of that reconnection of the trestles to the street ends. That being said, there is the larger project, which Jeff Harrington and Nathan Crater in the Public Works Department are working on, and that is the rebuilding of the trestles that we're budgeting $350,000 each year in Promote Astoria funds to be able to do that work. And we'll need to be doing that over the next 10 years to be able to continue to keep those structurally sound so that the trolley can run on there and it's open to the public for pedestrians.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, could we have a motion?
I move.
Go ahead, Tom.
I move that we approve the local agency agreement with ODOT for the waterfront bridges replacement project.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Our next item is a supplemental budget and public hearing for this waterfront bridges fund.
So again, this is an associated item, and the Oregon Revised Statutes provides guidance for when a municipality needs to adjust for changes within their budgets, and in this case, a public hearing is required to account for those changes. The City Council established the Waterfront Bridges Fund number 190 at your February 5th meeting with the understanding that there would be a supplemental budget brought back to you once the project funding requirements were developed. And that has now occurred because of the adoption of the prior item. And so what is needed now is a public hearing and also consideration of a supplemental budget to populate that budget which council has created with the appropriations, with the funds that are needed to move forward with the project. So Mayor, it's recommended that council conduct a public hearing and then approve the supplemental budget as presented.
Okay, I'll open the public hearing. Is there anyone who wants to speak to this item? Okay, close the public hearing. Council discussion.
Well, I can't believe nobody came out to talk about this tonight.
Anybody?
I move we approve the supplemental budget as presented in the draft resolution number 18 dash, is that a zero or four anyway, which outlines funding amounts.
Second.
Okay. Ms. Cosby, roll call.
Councilor Hemelwell?
Aye.
Councilor Brownson?
Aye.
Councilor Jones?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Mayor Lemire?
Aye. Thank you. The last item on our regular agenda is an accessory dwelling unit one-year report.
So at your April 17th, 2017 meeting, the council adopted a zoning ordinance amendment to amend regulations concerning accessory dwelling units. And in the ordinance, there was a provision that said that there should be an evaluation of the program in April of 2018 to recommend if any changes are needed. And this would ultimately go back to the Planning Commission for the initiation of any code amendments which are deemed necessary. You may recall at your March 5th, 2018 meeting, you had the Mattson family here who was wanting to utilize a mobile home, a small mobile home, as an accessory dwelling unit, and that is prohibited currently. Council at that meeting provided direction they wish the Planning Commission to evaluate the possibility of small manufactured homes to be utilized as accessory dwelling units. So that is one thing that's going to be on the work plan for the Planning Commission. What we have right here tonight is a report of maybe some other items for council to consider and providing direction that they would like the Planning Commission to work on. You'll note in the memo that there is kind of a description of what sort of comments or questions came in to the Community Development Department staff, particularly about inquiries about allowing accessory dwelling units and for duplexes. There are questions about the process for parking variances and options to address the parking requirements. There were inquiries about what defines a dwelling unit and so forth. So what we've seen is, you know, that there have been some additional accessory dwelling units put in place for Inside of homes, there has been no new construction of accessory dwelling units to date. But there's some feedback as to what was provided by some individuals, you know, expressing concerns with costs to convert the spaces as accessory dwelling units. So some policy questions that at least staff has identified for council to consider tonight is, should there be some discussion at the Planning Commission level about allowing some administrative variances for parking rather than a Planning Commission variance to be able to aid in the speed and also the cost for processing those types of variances? I would note that a type 2 variance, which is suggested, still would incorporate public notices to surrounding property owners. There's a question of, should a one vehicle parking exemption for an accessory dwelling unit be permitted if the primary residence already provides two parking spaces for the single family dwelling? There's a question of, should a conditional use permit for an accessory dwelling unit be changed to an administrative process rather than a public hearing before the Planning Commission? I would note that conditional use permits are only required in the R1 residential zone. And then lastly, should accessory dwelling units be permitted in association with duplexes when they're owner-occupied? And there are some other items which staff has identified which are maybe a little bit more providing some clarity to the code. There are some things that we feel would be good to be able to do just from a policy standpoint as well. First of all, we just want to have a clarification that the accessory dwelling unit must meet current building codes. We'd like to see an amendment to the purpose section of the code to state that it doesn't need to be an older, larger home. That was left over from old language. We'd just like to clean that up. We would like to see a reduction in the minimum required square footage of the primary unit, primary residence, from 1,400 square feet to 1,000. And this would allow smaller dwellings to have an ADU since the code is no longer aimed at larger, older homes. We're wanting to clarify that homestay lodging is not allowed in any of the dwelling units if there's an ADU on the site. That's something we'd like to be able to have some clarity on in that issue. And then also only require a formal pre-application on meetings which permits which require a conditional use permit or a parking variance. And this would help save some expenses for the applicant. I would provide just a heads up that, and this was kind of interesting, that we went through the process of having an amendment to the accessory dwelling unit code, and then the legislature passed legislation that required this. So we actually would have had to do this regardless. We were just ahead of the game. What we will be doing is taking a look at the state standards. We included with the council packet some guidance, which has been provided by the Department of Land Conservation and Development on accessory dwelling unit requirements. Some of this is requirements, some of this is advisory, recommended best practices that we have some purview on. What staff would like to have tonight is some direction from council, and we will take that and then start working with the Planning Commission on formal code amendments that would go through a public hearing process at the Planning Commission and ultimately end up at the City Council.
I have a question. On the last page that's signed by Rosemary, the third one down, should ADUs be permitted in association with duplexes when owner-occupied? Should they just be permitted in zoning districts where duplexes are allowed, or also permitted in zones where an existing non-conforming...
So for instance...
So you mean they somehow got in there without being...
Yeah, so for instance, we may have... We have had owners of duplexes in R1 single-family zones, meaning the duplex may have been built in the 1800s before zoning. Mm-hmm. And they came in to ask to have an accessory dwelling unit. So the policy question for council is, do you want to consider this even in the first place, where in multifamily zones and higher density residential zones, a duplex may be a permitted use. And so we're asking, do you want to consider that? And then in cases where there may be an existing non-conforming use, such as the R1 low density zone scenario, would, is that something you wish to be able to be considered?
Okay. Any other questions?
Are all of these points in the staff report items that you think Mr. City Manager should be brought to Planning Commission, and do you think that it would be helpful to update the code on all of these points, or is there anything that you don't agree would be an improvement?
So definitively on the second set of bullets, those are things that staff definitively feels should be brought to the Planning Commission. The first set of bullets, I think that this is something I would say that it depends on the City Council's purview. If you're wanting to be able to look at expanding the possibility of having accessory dwelling units within the neighborhoods, I feel that these are reasonable suggestions to go through the process. That there still is a public process. This is, while it may be changed from a Planning Commission review to a staff review, it still would include public notice. I would say that also with duplexes, if it's owner-occupied, staff wouldn't have a concern with that either.
Okay. And I'm curious what you think the implications of this point, should a conditional use for an ADU be changed to an administrative type 2 conditional use? A conditional use is only required for an ADU in the R1 zone. What do you think the implications of that would be?
I think the difference is it's the issue that we have heard from some individuals who have come to the counter, or they suggest that the process is too costly or onerous. I'll tell you, the cost savings wouldn't be tremendous, but it's a little bit that would be saved, but probably the processing time would be faster. It's more of a question of, does the council want to see maybe a little bit of an incentivization to incentivize the process a little bit.
What do you think the advantage to residents in the R1 zone might be right now to keep the code the same?
The difference would be, do they go immediately before the Planning Commission, or is there a decision-making process that goes to staff, still with public testimony, which is still appealable up the chain? I would look at it as if it's the neighborhood was fine with it, then the permit could get processed faster. If there were concerns with the neighborhood, mm-hmm. then it still would be appealable and still would be able to go up the chain through a more formal process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have a problem bringing any of these points to the Planning Commission for review.
I don't either.
Well, I don't either, except that I'm a no on 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the policy questions. I'm okay. I don't know, about 1,000 square feet seems awfully small to me on the recommended from 14 to 1,000. It gets very small. And then this caused me to look at the code itself again. So the dwelling unit shall not exceed 40% of the primary structure, or 800 square feet in size, whichever is smaller. That 40% is really almost half of what is typical in the state, which is generally 75%. So if you have a 1,000 square foot house, and then you can, an ADU only 40%, it's really small considering the cost of building one. So I wonder if one wants to look at maybe raising that a little bit. And then another thing that is, I see that we're allowing, I know that this came up, the LCPS recommended that we look at this, but I don't remember the conversation. I couldn't find the minutes. But we allow ADUs to be placed in front of a main dwelling. And I think that's a big mistake, particularly in the historic neighborhoods. I think that generally ADUs are on the side or in the back, you know, if they're not, if they're detached. And then one other thing is that on decreasing these fees by moving them from a type 3 to a type 2 review, you're really cutting out, I mean, you're basically making it $100 for a permit for an ADU. And I think it's $25 for a sandwich board. So I think that if all of these reviews are going to be cut out so that to decrease the fees, I still think that that perhaps then we should increase the ADU permit at least somewhat to make up for the lack of those fees that you're going to get.
Yeah, I will note that on the scenario for the Matsons, when they came here, they were actually, in their scenario, they were wanting to, they have a very wide lot, and I think they have a very deep setback. So let's say, hypothetically, they have a 50-foot front setback. They were wanting to put this new ADU in front of the front plane, so it'd have a 25-foot.
Are they in a historic district?
No.
I think that makes the difference. And I would really like to see in the development code that in a historic district, it really needs to be in the back or on the side, but not on the street side. That's my recommendation.
I had a quick, I had a couple comments here, but on the Matson thing, wasn't there a mobile home like 1,000 square feet?
That's right.
So, and how big is their house? I mean, there seems, was that going to fit within the criteria?
The issue at hand with the Matsons was that it was, that our code prohibited manufactured homes.
Right, I get that. But assuming we said, okay, in certain circumstances right. under review or whatever,
right.
This was going to have a larger footprint than is allowed as well, potentially.
So they were... No, there was a, when the Matsons were here, they were talking about some different issues, and there were two different code standards that they were referring to,
okay.
And they were asking for it to also be classified as a different type of, a manufactured home on its own lot
right.
would not have met the standard. What they were asking for was this to become an accessory dwelling unit.
Right.
In that case, the manufactured home standards on its own individual lot would not apply. So to make it simple, they were referring, there were two ways to be able to put a manufactured home on that we were looking at. One is if they platted their lot into two lots.
Right. But we're just talking about the ADU.
Right, side. Right. So there is not a minimum or maximum floor area size sure. with their proposal for an accessory dwelling unit. It's only the type of housing that they're wanting to put there. So the Matsons have a manufactured home.
Sure.
They came into the counter and they wanted to put a detached manufactured home on their lot, and we're told you can't do that because what you're wanting to put there is a manufactured home. They asked, what are our other options? They were told your other option is to divide your lot into two, create two lots. But when you create that second lot, any manufactured home would need to be a double wide under our code.
Right.
And they said, well, we don't want to put a double wide there. We only want to put a small part model, single wide there. And so that route didn't work for them either.
Right. Okay.
And do they have any rights of a, can they apply for a variance, or is that something that's just cut and dry? There is no exception.
You can't apply for, or the city can't grant what are called use variances, only numerical values.
Well, this isn't the time or the place to discuss that and my opinion on it, but I just want to say I feel very wary about allowing manufactured homes for being ADUs in Astoria in terms of character compatibility. I did see a gentleman with his hand up. FYI.
Any more council discussion, then I'll open it up for.
I was just going to say, given that when we amended the code last year, I believe the purpose for it was we wanted to address the permanent housing shortage by making it a little bit easier to have more ADUs and incentivize people creating ADUs to rent to permanent residents rather than to do short-term lodging in their homes, for example. So I'm in favor of these additional flexibilities, which are in my mind, they're in keeping with the intent of what we did last year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I guess I just had one more question for the city manager right now. These new state standards say that there should be one accessory dwelling unit for each detached single-family dwelling in the city. So I just kind of wonder how that would impact the size.
Well, what they're saying is that we should allow, that we have to, by state law, allow for one per unit. And if you see in their recommendation, they're recommending we allow two per unit.
But if it were a really small main house,
right,
then it would be an even tinier.
Well, so that's
accessory.
Why, right, and so that's why we have recommended as staff to reduce the minimum area for a house to 1,000 feet. But I think that there may be some flexibility that can be given on the other side as well for maybe a little bit larger ADU to be able to provide mm-hmm. more living space in that capacity.
Uh-huh. And so 1,000 would be small enough?
Well, 1,000 is what is the main house. So if let's say your main house.
Oh, okay. Got it.
That's what we're saying. Right now, the code says you have to be able to be allowed to have an accessory dwelling unit, your house has to have at least 1,400 square feet.
Okay.
What staff is recommending is that if you have a smaller house down to 1,000 square feet, you can still apply for an accessory dwelling unit.
Okay, thank you.
And the state statute, it does say, has some language about reasonable restrictions.
Correct.
And rules. So.
Okay, are we ready for public comment? Okay, sir, would you like to come up and give us your name and your address, please?
My name is Rick Culver. I live at 3506 Harrison, Astoria. And I came down to the meeting to address a similar issue, but at the end of the meeting, but being you brought up several things now on this ADU issue. This is something I've been dealing with the Planning Commission and the parking issue. At this time, I've been going through the city planner and the Planning Commission, and I've got nowhere on that. But I didn't know if this was the time to discuss that. But the one issue that the city manager brought up about duplexes, I didn't quite follow everything he said, other than possibility of trying to make a duplex into a short-term rental type of thing.
No.
Because I do have a duplex immediately across the street from me, and they do have long-term renters in there with minimal parking issues. So I wasn't quite sure on your duplex issue if you were allowing the Airbnb to be a short-term rental.
The congestion. We're not getting into Airbnb at all.
Homestay.
Yeah, not homestay. What we were saying is that if someone owned and occupied one side of a duplex, could someone build an accessory dwelling unit, an additional unit, in their duplex or detached from it? To put an accessory dwelling unit is an additional permanent.
Right. Residence. This is part of the issue I was going to discuss another time here, but after the meeting here, or can I discuss it now? It was a subdivision of a house and an ADU, making it into two different lots, and the parking issue. But
why don't you go ahead?
I didn't know if I need to wait later or
no. It sounds as though it has
The ADUs, the ADUs, and the parking issues, the off-street parking, and the hazards that it creates in my neighborhood.
Okay.
35th and Harrison is a busy intersection, and it's happened. They divided an ADU, a garage with an apartment above it, from the house, and took away the off-street parking for the house. So now they park on the street at the corner of 35th and Harrison by the Planning Commission, which I have tried to address ever since I got my public letter 10 years ago about this issue. Anyway, so this is some of the stuff you're talking about tonight with the ADUs. I have several, you know, motorhomes. I have a motorhome, travel trailer in the neighborhood that are accessory dwellings now being rented out, and several vacation homes in the neighborhood that are against the city ordinance for vacation homes. And other neighbors and I have talked about the parking issues that creates. But the parking issues are getting hazardous. Astoria Streets and these Astoria lots, they weren't made for large amounts of five or six cars per house anymore.
Okay.
And that's what creates. But this parking issue at 35th and Harrison, with no off-street parking, that was the Astoria Planning Commission. And I talked to city planner Nancy Ferber about this parking issue. And what she told me is different than what's actually happening now. But anyway, it was approved. So I'm still discussing it with her at this time. But okay. Means what you brought up about this, I didn't quite follow all that.
Wait,
duplex and so forth and the ADUs, what you're discussing. I've been against putting Airbnbs in residential neighborhoods. My neighborhood has an excessive amount of them. And they're not all through the business license here. You can go on the computer and you can see numerous places that are for rent, Airbnb and other weekend sites.
Mr. Culver, I think that perhaps you misunderstand. The ADUs that we're talking about, the accessory dwelling units cannot be, they are prohibited from becoming vacation rentals. They cannot be. I realize there's an enforcement.
It's easy to put that in ordinance here, but there's no enforcement behind it.
Yeah, I realize there's an enforcement.
Right, and that's what I hear you talking about, is enforcement issues on illegal rentals that aren't, shouldn't be happening. And that's something, as a council and at our staff, we're in the process of addressing it and looking for ways to bring enforcement to these issues.
Mr. Culver, maybe after the meeting, you and I can chat a little bit.
Yeah, I'd like to. I didn't know if that was, I didn't get all of it, but what you said there. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Chris?
Good evening, and I'd like to run a little bit with
what. Give us your name and your
Chris Hager, 68712. In regards to ADUs, it was a strategy for our housing crisis. And one thing that I wanted to make note of is there any discussion about possibly making a buildable lot size 2,500 square feet instead of 5,000, like other municipalities have done? Also, they've eliminated the parking requirement, and although I'm very sympathetic to parking in Astoria because we have a lot of narrow streets, there are areas with wide streets where, you know, cars and traffic can be accommodated. On my block alone, there are six homes that are about 2,500 square feet, and I'd also like to make sure that because they're non-conforming, that if something were to happen to these historic structures, that something else could also be built there. On a lot of 2,500 square feet, also maybe discuss adding an ADU to that. That is also common practice in other cities for dealing with dense housing, and we're limited by our growth boundaries here. So I'd like you to consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
So, Council, you know, the items that are brought forward tonight are not items that say, do you want them approved? It's, do you want them to be reviewed by the Planning Commission to have more dialogue and discussion and public input through the public hearing process? And so that's really kind of the ask this evening.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, I support that.
Yeah, and I think this isn't the first time that we're going to hear concerns about parking. You know, if we were to eliminate the requirement for there to be one off-street parking space for ADUs, you know, I think we're going to be hearing from more people from congested neighborhoods like yours on that as well.
Okay. Do you need a motion?
Why don't you, if you would, just to, if you can, maybe just wrap it up. You know, to be able to do that, and that provides, you know, some direction in moving forward specifically. So I mean, what I've heard is in general, there has been interest to move forward on. I guess what I've heard Councilor Price express some concerns about some of the first set of bullets, but generally I've heard support for looking at least all that, and I'm not saying that Councilor Price isn't even opposed to looking at it, but the motion would be to for staff and the Planning Commission to look at the bulleted items within the memo.
So I make a motion that the staff look at the bulleted items on this report and bring it to the Planning Commission for further review.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Thank you. That concludes our regular business. Is there anyone who wants to bring anything else forward at this time? Okay. This meeting is adjourned.